Okay, we're going to get ready to get started. There is a major change in today's schedule. So turn to your agenda page, and on day, what is today? Today 7? Today 8? On day 3, it says we're going to do catalogs. Mark that through. We're not going to do catalogs. What we're going to do is we're going to spend the first half of today doing product development. And you might want to write subtitles, how to develop the ultimate product for direct mail. And you want to open your legal pads to a fresh, clean page and write the words product development. By the way, I hope everybody had a pleasant evening. No one got arrested, I hope. I did hear a story about Gary Halbert in his underwear this morning. I don't know if it's true. And I heard something about my wife in his pants. I don't know if that's true either. Okay, we're going to talk about product development. We talked about a list a little bit yesterday morning. We're going to go into it a lot more today. And we're going to get everybody involved in developing the ultimate product that I can sell and make money. And the first rule in product development, and I believe Gary Halbert was the last person I heard this say, and I don't know if anybody said it before him. The first rule in product development is find out what people want and give it to them. So write that down. Find out what people want and give it to them. Now that's going to be the number one rule of what we do this morning is finding out what people want and giving it to them. And we're going to spend a lot of time, a lot of fun time, trying to decide what it is that people want and who these people are that want this stuff and then how we can give it to them. No, we're not selling anything. We're giving people the opportunity to buy. We're giving them an opportunity. It's actually our obligation as fine, upstanding citizens to help other citizens find what they want in life. So we're giving them the opportunity. We actually, all of us in this room are performing a service, a vital service needed in our society, and that's helping people find the things that they want. Of course, we do make a little money when we do that. So our number one rule is find out what people want and give it to them. Now, once we've got that rule down, there's a couple other rules that are pretty important to us. We want to be able to give it to them at a profit. So let's put down rule number 2. We have to be able to make a profit. Some of you may want to write, we have to make an obscene profit. I don't really believe in that philosophy. I think that you have to make a profit. And these other rules that I'm going to give you are just rules that you'll want in writing and rules that I will have want to have given to you. The third rule is that it must be legal. It must be legal, which means if you're selling a video recording of somebody, you need to have the rights to do that. And if you're doing an audio recording of somebody, you need to own those rights. If you're reselling anything that belongs to anybody else, make sure you have those rights. Make sure you're not selling drugs, obviously, or guns through the mail, or anything that might be illegal. Now, in your offer to the person, you can say things that further exploit the features of that product that might excite people to think that it might be illegal, but the product needs to be legal. And as for me, and I think it's real important, the product should be moral. I don't think that anybody in here should waste their time selling pornography or selling weight loss, stimulant type drugs, things that actually are going to be harmful to people because it's just not something you want to live with. You want to have a product that is moral.
Legal, ethical, and honorable, right?
Right, legal, ethical, and honorable. And I think those are rules that you should follow in everything you do. As a matter of fact, if you plan to stay in this business very long, you're going to have to do that. It is Only good business sense to do that, because your customers are going to appreciate it. They're going to feel good. They know that every time they buy something from you, they got what they were paid for. And they're not going to be offended by the mail that you open up. I'm sure that some of you have received mail in your mailbox that you wonder, how did they get my name? And I wish they wouldn't send me stuff like this. On TV, they're running commercials now that my wife and I would rather not see. They show previews of these horror movies where they chop up bodies. And personally, I don't want that in my living room. And I would be offended if somebody sent me mail like that, because that's not a product that I'm interested in. And that's something you don't want to do. Don't send mail that's going to offend people.
How do you feel about the 900 number? It's got a bad reputation.
I'm not involved in 900 numbers. I know there are a lot of people are who make money. According to some of the trend reports, it's really funny. After I read the Faith Popcorn Report, and about her team of people who get involved and figure out trends, she invited me to join, and I'm a member of the group now that writes the trends up. And that is what we call downtrend. The 900 numbers are out. I mean, there are so few people who get involved. Almost, you have right now, most people who are involved in 900 numbers are the people trying to make money. And the only people making money in 900 numbers are people selling you plans on how to make money with 900 numbers. Now, there are some smart people in this room who are making money with 900 numbers, but they're doing it in a above board legal manner, but they're still having problems. And Gary and I and Karen know somebody who was making between $250,000 and $500,000 a month, who's bankrupt now because of 900 numbers, because you get used to that, or he did get used to that high cash flow coming in every month, and then it just died. And it died because there's a lot of bad publicity about 900 numbers. You really don't want to get involved in anything that leaves a bad taste in anybody's mouth. Because your life does not need the complications. And I told you that early, and I keep telling you this, I'm the laziest guy on the planet. I don't need those complications in my life. There are so many easier ways to make money legally, honestly, and morally, that there's no need to even get close to somebody or something that might leave a bad taste in your mouth. And the worst part about 900 numbers is they could be illegal tomorrow. You may spend a lot of money ramping up your project, getting everything online, and things can change. You can ask John Eager. Things change overnight. Things that are legal today can be illegal tomorrow on the 900 numbers, because the Congress is getting more complaints about those than anything else. Plus, there's no guarantee that you get to keep the money. If you get 1,000 calls to your 900 number and all 1,000 people complain when the bill comes in, you don't get the money.
Well, the stigma, that's...
Yeah, the stigma is bad. Yeah, you don't want to... Right, you'll never overcome it. Now, that doesn't mean the 900 numbers aren't the greatest thing that ever happened. John, we'll hear from the other side of the story here. No, but I think John is going to tell you some things, important things.
Number one, we deal with a lot of people who are in the 900 business, and most of you should not be in it. Not for any of the reasons that Bill tells you, however. You should be in it because none of you, I suspect, have the tenacity, patience, or deep pockets necessary to figure out how to make money using it, because it is only another direct response tool. I do not agree that only criminals are in it. I do not agree that everybody in it is bankrupt. I do agree that there are more con men in it per square foot than you can find in any other business that any of you have any opportunity to get in. And it is by no means any sort of a get-rich-quick scheme. The most complicated money-making models that we could engineer in this room would be nothing compared to trying to make money and making money successfully using a 900 number as part of a program. So the reasons not to do it are all of those that Bill mentioned, but most singularly that there are very few people in this room who would have the deep pockets or the tenacity necessary to do anything other than cause yourself a lot of harm.
John, how much money would it take somebody who is a virgin, an absolute virgin to 900 numbers, to go from knowing nothing to making a profit? How much cash, and we're not talking about financing and backers, how much immediate cash, and how long would it take? Someone who's not...
There are two answers to the question.
Yeah, for John Eager, because John Eager has got a lot of experience and background. I mean somebody who's just got off the bus. Because they're going to have to hire somebody like you, or they're going to lose.
Well, they're going to have to hire somebody that's going to cost them a minimum of $60,000 a year, who understands the game to begin with. Okay, because your relationship with AT&T and your service bureau is what's going to either get you your money or not. And that relationship changes on a day-to-day basis, and you go from crisis to crisis when there is no crisis. And if you think that forgetting to put stamps on envelopes going out, or forgetting to put a place for somebody to write their name on a goddamned offer so that it can come back to you, both of which I have done, is anything, you should have AT&T the size of God breathing down your back. Because, I mean, that really will tighten you up. Realistically, out of pocket, if you can't spend $100,000, and you might get away with less than that, but it would cost, in my opinion, anywhere from $75,000 to $100,000 realistically before you could expect to receive a consistent stream of income. You might not spend all of it, but you could spend a large part of it. And some of it is luck and what you're trying to do. There are applications, very legitimate applications. You're going to see lots of respectable applications in local elections where local politicians use $5 contribution 900 numbers to raise money. You're going to see public radio stations using 900 numbers in place of their regular fund drives. You're going to see Pillsbury and Multifoods and General Mills and Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and Frito-Lay and tremendously large corporations moving into the 900 business.
But that's what you want.
You're going to
see, once they legitimize it,
well,
then it may be viable.
Well, yeah, you're going to legitimize it, but it's going to be like trying to be the ant under the rug the elephant's standing on.
Right.
You know, you're going to have to be so quick and agile not to, you know, be where that elephant steps the next time, that this, it's the hard way to go. So my opinion is that there are more con men, and there are people who have top spin on this that is just dazzling. This stuff flows across my desk daily. And there are people now who are selling people reconstituted cons. I mean, it's like going to the grocery store and getting orange juice that has been reconstituted four times down to this much. You know, and I mean, these things are so blatant and so transparent that nobody should get near them. Nobody. Absolutely nobody. We have had offers sent to us, and there are people I've met at seminars, and they say, gee whiz, what should I do? And I'm answering this guy's question. I'm having this conversation publicly, so I don't have to have it privately. I am answering your question. I've had people send me products, copy of the script, copy of everything and all this kind of stuff, and I write them a note and say, this will never make you any money, and send it all back with their check. Because it's, you know, if there's no possibility that you're going to do anything, then don't do it. So, in summary, and I'm trying to sugarcoat this for you, there is no likelihood that any of you will maintain an attention span sufficiently long to make money using a 900 number as part of a program, a serious direct response program. Number two, if you took a fraction of that money and invested it someplace where you understood what you were doing and where your lessons would be less expensive, you would make more money in the long run. And number three, for those of you who are entrepreneurial intensity junkies, which means that you have drip IV sitting next to your chair at the office, in which you take your intensity like into your soul as fast and as hard as you can get it to get your blood vessels shrunk down and your blood pressure up, then yes, that is a business for you.
John, I appreciate that short answer. It reminds me of point number four. Your product, the ideal product for direct mail, you ought to be able to describe it in the maximum period, should be a sentence. If you can describe it in three words or less, you even got a better product. You should be able to express somebody what that product is in a sentence, but ideally three words or less. So when somebody says, what are you selling? You can say, I'm selling a training tape. What are you selling? I'm selling a book. What are you selling? I am selling something. But if you have to preface it with a three-minute explanation, and then when you give the product idea, people still look at you like you haven't said anything, then you need to condense your ideas and thinking a little bit. Because until you get it down to that small little idea of what you're selling. Now, we're talking about physical product. It doesn't involve the offer. When you sell an offer, usually when you write an offer, you're not selling a product. You're selling an idea like hope or something else like that. But when you think about your product, it should be something you can define. So when people ask me what we sell videotapes. Or we sell books, or we sell newsletters, or in a larger sense, we sell information. And people ask me, what do I do for a living? I'm an information broker. And in most cases, we put that information in books, or in videos, or in newsletters. But we find out how the people who want that information want it first, and then we give it to them in that format. So it's very important to keep that in your mind. You ought to be able to find what you're selling in three words or less.
What was number three,
Bill? Should be legal, moral. That's where we went to the legal, moral, and ethical stuff. That's important, yeah. This is another one, and this is more mechanical than anything else. It should be, in most cases, UPS shippable. You know, that may seem like a small point. It's not a small point if you try to ship something UPS that's unshippable. We have come up with some very interesting failures in our lives. One of the more recent ones that somebody else talked about yesterday was in vaults. You know, we talk about people who have guns which are just on a gun vault. And we can buy the vaults for $550. Unfortunately, to ship them anywhere in the United States costs at least $600. And there's a 30-day minimum shipping period because UPS won't touch them. As a matter of fact, most truck lines won't touch them because they have liability claims by truck drivers trying to load these 600-pound vaults or 800-pound vaults into trucks. So while it was a great idea, great product, pretty good margin, it won't work. So it has to be UPS shippable. There are some products, and you need to find out from UPS what they won't ship. There are some chemicals they won't ship. UPS will generally ship almost everything. But they have to be UPS shippable. The plans would be good. That, right. Is Karen Anderson here?
No.
Hey, Karen, would you come up here? I know how shy you are and how you don't ever want to talk. And Karen Myers, would you come up here, please? Okay, so we have the, we have six on our list, right?
Five.
Jim, would you hand somebody to a mic, hand a microphone to somebody who looks like they're asleep and have them read their five items to me? Oh, wait, well, hand it to somebody who looks like they might slightly be crooked or do something, you know, that might be illegal, so that when they go to court for mail fraud, we can say, look, I told them this. Stand up, read this, get the camera.
You want me to read them all?
Yeah, I want you to read them all. I want you to read them slowly, and everybody said, that's right, that's what he said.
Okay. Help find what people want and give it to them, that's number one. Number two, we must make a profit. Number three is it must be legal and moral. Number four is describe it in three words or less. And number five is must be UPS shippable.
Very good. Karen says it shouldn't be fattening.
What? What am I looking at?
What I want you to do is pick a few pages from that and make photocopies that we're going to put on the slide projector. I'm going to show people how to find a targeted market. All right, now this is the, I want you to, now that's that list of rules. I'm going to give you the second set of rules. How to make money in direct mail. Rule one. Just be ready to do it. Yeah, rule one, how to make money in direct mail. Find out what people want and give it to them. And then there's a part A of that. That's rule one, part A. The product must be market driven. And that means you want to sell what people want. You don't want to sell something just because you have it, or just because it's in your comfort zone, or it's just because that's what you want to sell. You don't say, you know, I've got this pile of books in my closet. Who can I sell them to? And that is what we all do. I mean, that's what we all do. Unless we want to make money. If you want to make money, what we say is, what does the market want, and then let's find it. The biggest mistake I had is I kept wanting to sell things that I wanted. And one of our biggest failures that fortunately didn't cost me money, because part of the failure was one of the reasons I couldn't follow through, was I was going to produce a videotape on how to live without electricity. I thought this was the greatest idea in the world. How to live without electricity. We did the press releases and ran some ads. And it was funny, we didn't get a single phone order. I got several letters from people who said, I want your videotape. I don't have a telephone, so I can't place an order. And by the way, since I don't have electricity, I don't have a VCR to play your tape on. And that's when I realized I'd made a mistake. Is that I was trying to sell a tape to people who don't have VCR video players. But it was such a great idea. So, you know, we all make mistakes. And that one cost me about $450. In the first letter from the first person, I hit my head. And I said, I know what I did. I did wrong. And really, that was a good product, but it's just something we couldn't sell. So you have to sell what people want. Now, had I put that product in a book, I might have been able to sell it. But they wouldn't have been able to read the book because they don't have light, so they have to read it in the daytime, you know. So it's one of those situations. I should tell you about all the other products that have failed. You know, I guess if Ted Nicholas and I sat up here and just told you what we tried that didn't work, and if Gary Habert told you what he tried and didn't work, it would take us days and days and days to get through the list. But you would think that we guys are the biggest idiots in the world. And we don't want you to think that. Oh, wait. Yeah, wait. I've got something here. I want to tell you. We learned this at dinner last night. And you want to write this down. Go to a separate page. This is a real important rule. Write down how to make sure that anyone who's ever spent a dime with you will never do business with you again. Now, Pat McAllister, Pat and Sandy here, told us this last night. In order to come to seminar, they're in the drug mail business. They came to a drug video boot camp, and they actually produced a videotape. I've pointed them out several times, and their success, or almost success. We decided last night they can't afford to be successful. They're so, it's like they're standing on the edge of success, and to step over this line is going to cost them another $400, $500. But they're so scared that they just can't step over that line, and I know how it is. But what they did to come to the seminar, they said, you know, we've got all these good customers. What we're going to do is send them a letter right before we come to Hot Springs. And that way we'll generate enough sales to come. And the letter said, final chance. And it was a nice, relatively nice, well-written letter. And they weighed the letter and in the envelope and put it in there, stuffed it, licked it, put the label on it and a stamp and mailed it. Mailed 400 letters. And they got a call from a guy who said, you know, I got your letter. He said, actually, I had to go down to the post office, stand in line 20 minutes to get the letter and pay 23 cents postage. And what had happened is that after they put the stamp and the label on it, it pushed it over to 1.1 of an ounce. So, and this was a nationwide mailing. Can you imagine 400 people standing in line in the post office to pay 23 cents to get your direct mail offer that says, final chance, if you don't order now, we'll never send you another letter. What will you do? Now, we decided that what they could have done to improve on that was not put a stamp at all. Yeah, postage due. But what was amazing was even with that, they got 4 orders so far.
Bill, I want to point out that there is a great deal of success in what you just said. It isn't that we could all get together and have, and I understand that Halbert has had more interesting successes and failures than anybody I've ever met, and I'm sure that Ted has a lot that he doesn't tell anybody except his very best friends about. And I certainly have my favorite for the year, which is failing to put an address and a name place on an order form. But the fact is that what distinguishes us from all of the other people in the world is that that won't stop us.
Yeah, we learned from, we actually wrote it.
Well, down. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I would like to really rest assured that the people who proofread this thing before it went out in my office would not make that mistake again, but it don't matter because it's really my fault because it was filth and my money and I'm the last desk it passed by, okay? But the fact is that not only don't we quit, but we don't quit in the face of making the same mistake with different faces again and again, because frequently we have a mindset. It's like me and computers. I have this after I do something twice one way on a computer, I think, aha, this is faster, and then I blow the damn thing up. And because it doesn't do it that way. Okay, well, it's the same way. I have a tendency to make a certain kinds of mistakes, and so I try to have staff or somebody check, like, these are the 3 things that I always screw up, so check those, and I'll check all the rest of them. But the fact is that not only don't we quit, but eventually we learn from whatever that mistake is. And I think that's the distinguishing factor. It isn't that you found out that nobody with electricity or people with electricity, people needed electricity to use the product you were going to provide them, you had this little kind of blinding aha. The more important thing about that was not that you had the aha, but that you abandoned the project.
Immediately.
That you didn't try to invent some half-assed way of getting them to watch your videotape without electricity to run a VCR, which is the temptation of most of that confronts most of the people in this room, that you fall in love with your product. And therefore, when you find out that this is the dumbest idea...
Oh, no, that wasn't the dumbest idea.
You've had more ideas. But the point is that you don't quit. And the difference between people who are successful and not successful are whether they quit or not. It's fine to have a bad idea. It's fine to make a mistake.
I was just thinking about one of the other ideas we did. Jim, is Jim in here, Jim Powell? We had a lady who trained Rottweilers. She wanted to do a videotape on how to train guard dogs. And Jim went out there, and one of the dogs happened to be in heat. And some of the male dogs couldn't tell Jim or the lady from which dog was in heat. So you got these Rottweilers, there's probably 20 of them there, with goats. And she had peacocks and cats and a cameraman with lights and cables and a lady who's afraid she doesn't look quite right, who really can't concentrate on what's going on, plus 20 Rottweilers, plus another 40 other breed dogs in kennels behind them, barking at all this excitement and activity. Yeah, that was an exciting day. Well, let's have a microphone up here. Let's just take 30 minutes and talk about the biggest mistakes we've ever made in marketing. This might be interesting.
Yeah, it's fine.
Well, well, 30 minutes is not enough.
It took time. Can I stand up?
Yeah, you better stand up. You're kind of...
does anybody get here Bill Donahue's money letter? Anybody get financial newsletters? okay, is that better?
Closer to your mouth. You're just not tall enough. See what it is. Either that or your arm's not long enough. There you go.
Bill Donahue is about 6'11 and about 400 pounds, wouldn't you say, Ted? He's really quite a large man, and he is chronically on a weight loss program. He's done every weight loss program that you can think of, and he went with Delta, what's her name, from the... Yes, he was in a, you know, that farm with her, and, you know, he's always trying to lose weight. He's a dear man, very sensitive. He's a very bright man and deals with mutual funds, has this great reputation, has done radio, talk shows, all sorts of things. So we were doing a renewal piece for the Donahue money letter, and we had it. It was really quite financial and sound and impressive and all those kinds of things. And we sent it back to L.A. for final approval to the woman who was managing the account for the renewal piece we were writing. And we made this one little error that we wrote Bill Donahue instead of Donahue. And fortunately, we caught the error. We just, for some crazy reason, ran the spell checker and included Donahue in it, and it caught it. And so we changed it. We just hadn't changed the copy before we sent it out to L.A. for final approval. And we got this frantic phone call, and we were mailing, like, I don't know, 50,000 pieces. And we had this frantic phone call that said, "Have you printed this yet?" And we said, "Yeah, it's already gone to the printer." And she went, "It says Donahue." We didn't know we caught it. So that one was one that we caught. But I guess my point is, it's one thing if you're mailing your own stuff and you screw up. You have to be real careful when you're mailing other people and they're paying you to mail it. So please know that I have screwed up enough that I'm real cautious about those kinds of things. So no guarantees, but you have to be real careful.
Since we're on the subject of screw-ups, I don't believe anybody in the room can top me for screw-ups. I'll tell you about some of them. The last direct mail piece I did was a renewal piece for people who didn't renew to my newsletter, and I did an order coupon, and I cleverly forgot to put the price of the subscription in it. I ran a full-page ad in the New York Daily News. It's just a huge circulation newspaper. You could only order by an 800 number. And we put the wrong 800 number in. Probably the most classic mistake I ever made in my early days, I thought that you could sell by using humor. And I had a weight loss product, and I ran a full-page ad in the Akron Beacon Journal. And I decided to advertise the advertising by running a radio spot. And I fell so in love with the radio spot, I recorded it in my own voice. And for about 5 days before the paper broke, the people in Akron, Ohio, heard the following radio announcement. "Attention all fat people. Does your garbage man deliver instead of collect? Then yell, chow time. Whenever you get on an elevator, no matter what button you push, does it always go down?" when you go shopping for food, do your neighbors laugh behind your back and say, that little piggy went to market again? You know, fat ain't where it's at. Learn how to get rid of it. Read the Akron Beacon Journal on Thursday. Look for the headline that says, the world is full of fat people. Here's how you can help get rid of them. And then I close by saying, bye, Porky. Well, then the ad... The theme of the ad was that there's too many people in the fat room and they suck up more than their fair share of the earth's resources. It takes more cloth to make their clothes. It takes more gasoline to cart their fat asses around. And all the rest of this, and by buying this product, you know, you could help. You know, I can tell you that was about 20 years and 35 pounds ago, and I don't find being fat so damn funny now. But that entire campaign, the radio spot, the full page ad, everything, netted me exactly 3 orders. One other marketing mistake I didn't personally make, I don't know if you could call it a marketing mistake, but I was in the studio there. In California, where they shoot TV shows, you know, nobody cares what they're shooting. They only care that they get to work. And there was this one studio that shot this evangelist, you know, I'm going to heal you, you know, all that stuff where all the Christian things come in. And across the hall, they were shooting a pornography show. And they made a mistake, and they sent all the Christians into the porno set, which really did not work too well. So... that's just some of mine.
All right, who else in here wants to admit up to a few marketing major? Oh yeah, Ted, I kind of was hoping you put your hand up.
There have been so many that some people would call all the failures that I've had, we want to put them in the Hall of Shame instead of the Hall of Fame. I guess the biggest one that I can think of was in 1987, a few years ago. We had one of my clients who incorporated through my company, became from Canada, became an expert in for big corporations in helping them to determine what their driving force is. Because many corporations, including small ones like mine, or relatively small, Fortune 500 ones do this all the time, but even medium-sized companies, don't really know what their driving force is. And amongst my top 6 people in my company, there was even confusion because a lot of people felt that we were product-driven in the sense that we have all these products for small businesses and entrepreneurs, and it was like divided in half. And the other 3 thought, we are marketing-driven. Of course, I was convinced from the very beginning we're marketing-driven, but I wanted my people to be fully integrated on that idea. So we had a weekend workshop where we determined that we went through a long series of exercises, fascinating. We came out with a unanimous conclusion, we're marketing-driven, and we can market anything on earth. So with that information and with a lot of money in the bank at the time, because everything we were doing was working, you know, sometimes half of what you're doing is working, or 3/4, sometimes 1/4, sometimes 1/10. Everything was working. We had a lot of money in the bank. So I thought, I'm going to go buy a product that somebody else is under-marketing, and I'm going to market it myself. So we learned about, we ran ads in the Wall Street Journal, we did all kinds of things, and we got, one of the products is called, we said, this is it, it's called Auto Racing USA. It's the number one publication in auto racing that covers the field, and a beautiful color book that is a collector's item, really. And I hired the number one editor in all of auto racing to work with us, because no one on our staff is an expert. And we hired, instead of writing the copy myself, because I'm not an auto racing buff, I hired the top copywriter in New England that writes all the copy for auto racing publications and so forth and magazines. And we developed this program. Well, we spent $350,000, and we didn't test. We thought, we've got the greatest product. We fell in love with the product. The greatest product. The greatest editor. The greatest copywriters. Now, several bad things happened. The mailing house didn't insert the pieces, among other things. The mailing house didn't insert the pieces in proper sequence. And the particular piece was done in such a way that it was depending on the sequence of things that you have in the letter, because it has to be every offer has to be staged. Well, to make a long story short, we got like 3 orders, you know, incredible, and spent $350,000. boy, oh boy, every time I think of that, it just makes my blood chill, you know? And it, but it taught us a lot of things that, you know, with success comes the tendency to fall even more in love with your products and just make those kind of errors. That's one. There are a lot of others. I mean, a lot of other products that I've fallen... See, I personally, I fall in love pretty easily with products, with people, with women, and with life, with a lot of things, with sports. And so I have a tendency to fall in love with products, the same things that a lot of you have. I fall in love... Well, I don't want to publish a book that somebody else has written unless it's the greatest book that anybody ever wrote on the subject in the world. So that's what I seek, and I fall in love with it. Now, the problem is it's very hard, and I write the copy for it. And I hire the best copywriters in America to compete with my copy because I want to find out which one is going to do the best job, because that's what really counts. When it does, we all win. And unfortunately for me, really, 95% of the time mine wins. And I say that unfortunately because it's very hard to find copy because it's such an integral part that really works and people that understand the entrepreneurial market and all. But so my tendency in all of the enterprise products, when we come out with a book, I know or I feel in my heart it's the best there is on the subject. And when we can't make it work, I tend to throw more money at it and try more ads and more direct mail pieces. Now, sometimes I turn losers into winners, and that encourages me to be even more, to fall in love with my products even more. But it's very hard for me to step back and say, it's time to quit. It's time to just put our money and time and effort somewhere else. But anyway, those are what I wanted to...
That's the curse of having too much money. I mean, the curse of having too much money is that you're willing to spend a lot of it to make something work, when really you should test on a very, very small budget, and if it works. Because if you do it that way, it forces you to do it right. I mean, it forces you not to be sloppy when you're on a... I mean, if we only have $600 to test, and there have been a lot of times that I only had $600, or sometimes that I only had $120 and a lot of more bills due than that when I first got started. And that forces you to do things right. I mean, it gives you a lot of motivation to do things right when you only have a limited amount of money. I'm going to tell you another thing that you shouldn't do. You shouldn't write an offer, take it to the printer, get it printed up, bring it back, hire some pretty sexy little girl and say, I want you to put all the stamps on these things and mail them, and then not look. Because 2 years later, you may walk in the back of your building and say, what are all these sacks back here? So it's really important to mail your offer. And I'm going to put that down here as another way to screw up any mailing is don't mail it. Just write it, package it, spend the money, but don't mail it.
Bill, there's another thing that might be useful to add to that list, which is pay attention to other experts. When we, Phil and I, got a licensing agreement on a pet enzyme that Synchronol is running an infomercial on, and Sugarman had run it as a test at the same time that he ran his sunglasses, but his sunglasses worked so much better, and he only does one thing at a time, so he set this aside. So we got the rights to all the Sugarman tape, all of the testimonials, everything. And then in the middle of negotiating this deal, Synchronol came in and said, we want the infomercial rights. And the guy obviously went with Synchronol. So Phil says, well, let's take all the other rights, which sounds all right, I guess. But all of the research and due diligence we had done was about doing it this way, the way Sugarman had shown it and the way it could be put together cheap and we could get to the market to find out whether it worked. So we took all the print and radio rights. And then we called up Chase Revelle and said, say, Chase, has anybody ever made radio infomercials work? He said, no. Why? Well, because people who listen to radio don't have a pencil handy, and frequently they're not near a phone. Because radio is one of those things that you do back here, way back in the back of your mind. Phil says, oh, thanks for telling me that. So we went out and spent $25,000 making radio infomercials, which we instantly lost. So when you call up somebody... Listen to what they tell you. If nobody has ever made something work, you're not going to make it work. It's not going to work.
I know, Sam. I'd also like to make a comment. Can somebody multiply for me what 50,000 times 30 cents is? Can somebody multiply for me what 50,000 times 30 cents? 15 grand. One of the things that's important to know is live stamps are valuable. If you've got $15,000 tied up in postage and you're putting live stamps, you want to make sure that people do not rip off your stamps because they actually are valuable. In the letter shop guy that I use that does really huge mailings has said people will steal stamps. These stamps are valuable. They can resell them. They can discount. There's a black market for stamps. And I went, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. He said, but when you're talking $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of stamps, they're valuable and there's a black market for it. So one of the things that's really important to do is to know and personally supervise what's going on with your mail drops so that you actually can make sure that the stamps are getting on the letters and that you actually make sure the letters are getting in the mail, that you actually make sure that it's really getting out. And the whole idea of seating and having a P.O. box or a return address where you're actually getting the Nixies back, all those things are really important so that you know what's happening. Because if you're putting that kind of money, if it's a dollar a name and you lose 5,000 pieces, you've lost $5,000. And that really is actual real money. So really be careful about when you're using live stamps, and I do recommend live stamps because it gets it open. But be real careful about what's happening with your mail.
You know, we ate dinner with Pat and Sandy. I pick on them a lot, but it's so much fun because they're where I was about 2 years ago. And a lot of the stuff they tell me is the exact same things I did because they're trying to work this thing on a budget. And what happens is every time they try to save money doing something, it comes back to bite them real hard, and they discover that if they would have spent a little bit more money to do it right the first time, they would be enjoying a lot more money right now. One of the things that we did is that we had 10,000 of the finest letters ever wrote printed up for us with a real nice offer and a real nice envelope. But we decided, you know, we put so much money in this project that we're going to save a little money. So I was looking at the back of Income Opportunities Magazine. Have any of you seen Income Opportunities Magazine? And there's a full-page ad that says, mailing list available, 1,000 names, $20. And we said, hey, good price. We bought 10,000 names, say it's $200. Hey, it saved us at least $1,200. We mailed 10,000 pieces, postage is 29 cents a piece, $900 for that. Printing on 10,000 pieces was about $1,000, $3,900 of that. But hey, we saved money on postage. We only had to pay $200, I mean, not postage, for the names, $200 for the names. Mailed out 10,000 letters and got zero response.
Bill, can I? I've got one for you.
Oh, good. Hey, I want to ask you a question, Lisa. Having to eat dinner alone? Is anybody in here taking you to dinner?
Are you kidding? I've been wine and dine.
Oh, you've been wine and dine. Good.
I wrote with a partner an information product for legal administrators, and I wrote the sales piece. And we priced it at $129.99, thinking that this was going to be the magic price, and we didn't test that. So we rolled it out, and I got three orders. You know, three stinking, lousy orders. So we just sort of slapped a little label over where it said how much the price was, and we dropped it to $99, and bingo, all of a sudden we got a lot of orders for this product. So make sure that you test your orders, test your prices, test your copy, because you can't be content to just roll things out, even on a limited basis, without understanding what some of your variables are and what makes people buy. And you aren't going to know everything, you know, just got to roll with it.
Ted said this yesterday, and it's worth repeating, because you don't decide the price of your product. The market decides the price of your product. And we just can't say that enough, because I may say, oh, that's definitely a $99 product, or that's definitely a 1995 product, and it's definitely a $400 product. It's not definitely anything until the market says they'll buy it. And then if you know that you get a response at that price point, then you know that that's the price you pay. The other thing to really know is that there are a lot of times that people err on the side of pricing things too low instead of, you know, just pricing them too high. Because a lot of times, if the price on something that's really valuable is $19.95, then people go, well, it can't be that great if it's only $19.95. And a product will sell better at an $89 price point than at a $19.95 price point because of the perceived value of whatever it is you're selling. So the whole point is how do you get the market to tell you what the price is they're willing to pay? Yeah, I mean, what's the answer?
Test.
You test. Right. Guys, you're doing great. What? You want, here, repeat that, and then we'll do... I know. Oh, come on.
You can always start out high, and then if it doesn't work, you can drop the price. Because it's easier to drop the price than it is to raise the price. You start out too low, and you want to...
Well, that's one of the smartest things I ever heard anybody say. You know, the very first time I met Gary Halbert, I was down in Key West, and I walked into his offices up there, and there's Gary in a pair of cut-off shorts, sandals, a sleeveless shirt, a scraggly beard, with about 20 people around him. I thought, this is Gary Halbert. This is what everybody's down here. I talked to Gary. He said, come here. And I started talking to him. He said, well, tell me what you're doing. I told him I was doing the newsletter. And he said, what's the subscription price? And I said, $19.95. And he shook his head. He says, you need to be charging a whole lot more. And I said, Gary, no one will ever pay more than $19.95 for my newsletter. I said, I'm having a hard time signing up people now at $19.95. He says, charge more. And I said, okay. And I walked away and I said, what a nut. This guy don't know anything. How did he get to be such a guru? Well, now 2 years later, our subscription price is well over $100. $185 is the printing price on our subscription price. And we have more than the same number of subscribers. But assuming you have, let's just say you got 1,000 subscribers and they're all paying $19.95, that means that you're making $19,995 a year from your newsletter. Now, if you bump the price up to, say, let's just say $100 on the average, and you have 1,000 subscribers, your income goes to $100,000 a year from your newsletter. How much have your expenses gone up?
Zero.
And you know what's nice? Is that when you charge $100 for a product, you get a nicer, gentler kind of client. You get a more intelligent person, a person who understands the value of a product. People who aren't grubbing by to come up with $19.95. That's the problem with the $19.95 price. Because people who are paying for high-dollar products, to them, $19.95 must, you know, is nothing. I mean, where I won't go out and spend $60 or $70 for a meal, a lot of people will. And when you sell something for $19.95, that is absolutely nothing anymore.
There's another way to test price, and we haven't talked about A-B splits, and this is probably a good time. One of the things that you can do is you can do half of your mail drop can be $19.95, the other half can be $89.95. And you can divide it into an A and a B, and you can split it, and then you can track your response and find out, you know, did 5 people buy it at $19.95 and 122 bought at $89.95, or was it the opposite? And that way you can, you know, you have sort of a safety valve to be able to test what kind of price point people are going to respond to. And that you can do with your printer and with your list. Carl?
Hello. It's not directly directed to that, but just in general, you know, John talked about the radio infomercial not working, and I don't think you can make a radio infomercial work either. But one thing you ought to realize, I'm gonna zig while, you know, maybe we were zagging a little before. Colonel Sanders went around and knocked on about 1,000 doors trying to sell his chicken recipe before he finally got somebody to buy it. Thomas Edison tried 10,000 different ways to invent the light bulb before he finally got it. And just because I don't know how to make a radio infomercial work, or John doesn't know how to make it work, or nobody in here knows how to make it work, doesn't mean someone can't make it work.
If they have enough time and money.
Yeah, if you have enough time and money, if you've got the right idea, if you within yourself say, I think I know how to make this work, and test it, for very little money. You know, don't go out spending a lot of money, but figure out how to test it for little money. And there's one thing you ought to realize, even if the first test doesn't work, that doesn't necessarily mean the product doesn't work. You don't know if it's the product, your copy, the offer, or whatever. You've really got to analyze this from all sorts of different points of view. And all the stuff you're getting here at this entire seminar has to factor in and integrate. And, you know, when you sleep on it and 2 or 3 weeks later, don't even worry about what you learned over here. It'll just surface and you'll gain a lot of knowledge that you're learning here, but that will kind of become part of you and you'll use that. Don't be so concerned over dropping it too soon either, is my point. And really make sure you know that you need to test it. Like, you know, we're always saying test, test, test. Make sure you test it real cheaply and learn from it.
Please, stop.
No, we're going to stop and I'm going to put you to work. No,
no, one more. I promise.
Have you guys ever had to deal with women?
I'm sure they haven't. The other thing to know is that it's your timing of when you drop your mail piece is also important.
No, we're going to talk about that. Don't talk about that.
No,
now. I don't want you talking about that. We're going to talk about it later.
Bill,
no, we're going to talk about this later.
Can I make one very quick comment? When you're going out to develop a product, try and sell solutions to problems people are already worried about. And that's a very key thing there, that they are already worried about. For example, not what you think they should be worried about, even if it's real, but what they should be. And a good example of that is all the people, John just said radon, and he read my mind, I was going to say it. Everybody's trying to sell protection from the menace of radon. I don't know of anybody that's done that successfully, because maybe people should be worrying about that, but they are not already worrying about that. You know, so sell solutions to problems people are already worried about.
Okay, I'm going to put one final thing here, and this is the number one reason. The number one reason people fail in direct mail. This is the number one reason. This is going to be the reason that 95% in this room of the people are going to fail in direct mail. And the reason is, the number one reason most people fail is they don't do anything at all. It's just so much easier not to do anything. It's so much easier to think about getting that book written or getting that videotape written or lining this up or getting an office or buying a computer and buying a better computer or buying a better printer or buying more video equipment. It's so much easier doing those things or saying, I'll wait till I retire or I'll wait till I have more time or I'll wait till my kid's out of college than to do something. I was talking to someone in the hot tub last night and they said, I am so scared to take that step, to mail those first 1,000 letters. I am so scared that something's going to happen. And I said, let me tell you what's going to happen. You're going to mail 1,000 letters and nothing is going to happen. And that's why you test. You're not going to get 100, you're not going to get 100 phone calls. Isn't that right? We have our resident experts here, Pat and Sandy. Isn't that right? Oh, why don't Pat, you and Sandy both come up here. You guys got to hear this story. This is going to be you in 6 months.
I think you should have Pat start with the story of the letters
from Hunter. Oh, yeah. Let's start with the very first letter where they were...
A lot of foundation. And it's very useful in understanding about what you're about to hear.
Now, these people are real entrepreneurs. Right? They went to a seminar. They actually have done it. They were virgins. They've got their feet wet. They got into their knees. They got up into their hips. Now they're up to about their necks in it.
And we're driving.
But they're so close to being a huge success. And they know where their problem is.
One of them.
One of the... How many people subscribe to Bill's newsletter? And maybe for the last 2 years. How many people remember an issue in Bill's newsletter where he sent you a copy of what he thought was one of the best sales letters ever, and it was a guy selling a karate tape, and in the sales letter it was described how this guy didn't take karate for exercise, he didn't take karate for peace of mind. He didn't take it to feel more self-confident. He took it so he could drop a guy with one punch. He took karate so that if he was in the tavern, he could break a leg, someone else's. And at that moment, I was putting together my product, my idea. And what we had was an idea of how to teach people or help people who come to our state to go hunting, big game hunting. Number one, because we could find their names easily. They register with the Department of Wildlife and we can get their names for Nicola Page. So we knew who they were, and what they wanted was to be able to hunt private land. So we took Bill's letter as our guide and we said, we don't go hunting because we like beer drinking. We don't go hunting because we like to chase women. We go hunting because we like to kill things. We went on for 8 pages. We had hate mail for 3 months. We had an 800 number to call in on, and people would stay on the line until we explained kindly that we could find out who they were. Because they wouldn't get off the line. They wanted to just run up our bill. They were so angry. And I was running my other business at the time, and my employees from my computer store were taking these calls. They were calling in sick. They wouldn't come to work. They didn't want to take any more calls from these irate people.
Did you explain how your hunting technique worked? You explain how the hunting technique worked? What the tape was about?
Don't they just kill, no. Don't hunters just kill things? I mean, is that what you mean? What the hunting technique
is? Oh, no, this is even better.
Well, no, I wanted to insert...
No, imagine Bambi in the woods... imagine Bambi in the woods with a little tracker that the Game and Fish Commission used to track deer animal movements. And then imagine somebody offering you a videotape showing you how to tune in those frequencies.
Oh. Oh. Bambi meets Godzilla.
Well, actually, in Colorado, ranchers can claim game damage and get payments. And what we were doing was getting those names of the people who were claiming game damage and sending hunters to knock on their door.
Well, I thought the most interesting thing is that there is, as a customer, pissing off people with big guns who are used to shooting at small, fast-moving targets. I thought, when you brought this up at the last seminar, I thought that the fact that you still got any hair at all is a total mystery.
So that was their first try, and they got tremendous amounts of hate mail and did a lot of things wrong.
Wait, I know...
But they kept going. Now you got to hear about what's going on now.
Wait, before you do that, Bill, I know how to make that work.
Okay. No.
Thank you.